The Guardian.
She called an election 3 years early and made it all about her. Now, with her poll lead narrowing and her advisers blaming each other, does Theresa May have a plan B?
Meanwhile, Jeremy Corbyn and Labour appear to be coming up on the rails as the smaller parties struggle to get a hearing. I'm Owen Jones.
And I'm Jonathan Friedland. And on what should have been a Sunnybank holiday Monday with 10 days to go, what better time to take a step back and assess the state of the race? So, I want to begin today by looking hard at this Conservative campaign, Owen. I mean, the one thing I think people did not plan for is the idea of sort of hyper-capable, you know, local head teacher Theresa May presiding over a campaign that even people who are supportive of the Tories say is probably the worst campaign they've ever seen. I mean, it is spectacularly, epically incompetent. And the sort of heart of the incompetence was this dementia tax, which we talked about in our very first one of these. We couldn't quite believe it then. She did do a sort of discreet or disguised U-turn later that day, but no disguising it really. It was an extraordinary thing to just take a massive kick at your core supporters. And their campaign, in a way, obviously Manchester bombing sort of suspended everything. But as a campaign, it hasn't ever really properly recovered from that.
No, and what's interesting is that this whole campaign for the Tories was supposed to be a presidential campaign. The big choice, Theresa May, Jeremy Corbyn, and, you know, look at the polling. A huge personal lead at the very beginning of the campaign. So much so that on all the campaign buses, all the campaign literature, you could barely even see the word Conservatives. It was always Theresa May. The problem with this gamble was the British public didn't really know Theresa May. She had these very tightly controlled appearances on the media, which were quite rare. And even though during this campaign she tried everything she could to avoid scrutiny, avoiding debates and so on, inevitably people have got to know her a bit more. Now, when she makes herself the strong, capable, decisive pair of hands you can trust, and then the centrepiece of her entire manifesto collapses, suddenly that choice is not quite as clear as they would have wanted in the first place. And that is one of their key problems.
And I think your point about people not knowing is completely right. But I think they so could have just gone with that. They should have gone with the grain of that. And there was a style of campaign, a template of campaign that was there for the taking. In the United States, if you're the incumbent, they talk about running a rose garden strategy, which means you run the campaign from the White House. You are the president, so don't pretend to be the president. Don't go out campaigning. Don't go out shaking hands. Leave that for the sort of the smaller fry beneath you who have to campaign. You're the elevated person. She could have just stayed in Downing Street, actually done hardly any campaign events, preserve the mystique, because I agree with you that people didn't know her, then just be the prime minister. Jeremy Corbyn may make his political points and Tim Farron may try over at the margins, but I'm the prime minister. And I think it would, you know, it's not brilliant in terms of scrutiny or democratic accountability, but actually would have been very effective that she would have remained this person who was working through, you know, burning the midnight oil, running the country while these lesser people are out politicking.
And now the problem they've got is that dreaded word relaunch. Whenever politicians are talking about relaunches, that's when you know they're in quite a bit of trouble. And you've got reports of her key advisors, Fiona Hill and
Nick Timothy. In the sack.
Absolutely. The blame game has begun. Linton Crosby, who's supposed to be this kind of Machiavellian genius, but who can just, you know, engineer election victory after election victory, apparently seems to be briefing against his own campaign, because obviously he has a brand to protect and he's looked at this. I mean, look, for them, this was supposed to be an absolute walkover. The Conservatives were going to crush Labour as a political force in Britain. That was their strategic aim, nothing less. So if we end up now, and privately the Tories are briefing that if she gets less than an 80-seat majority, that will look like a loss,
yes,
given
well,
where it started.
Partly because it was an election she didn't need to have. She chose it, as you say, in order to seize this political moment where the Labour Party were ripe for crushing, is how they saw it. That was the whole reason for doing it.
Why crush the saboteurs?
Well, they just thought there's a goal and it's yawningly open and there for the taking. So why not shoot, you know, bang into it? And instead they have created themselves, given themselves a bit of a fight. But it's this same point about how they began. If you already begin, she was in some polls almost 50 points ahead on who's most qualified to be prime minister. So just sit on that. And I don't even understand why the manifesto wasn't 2 pages full of platitudes and nothing else. We'd have howled at The Guardian and we'd have said, you know, where are the policies? You've got to be more accountable for the next 5 years. But she could have just frozen in aspic this advantage she had. Why put anything in a manifesto, let alone a promise that could be so contentious. And I think what she was doing was, you know, in some ways you could almost think it was quite high-minded, which was, I want a mandate. I don't just want a landslide. And there were columnists saying this. She should get a mandate and actually put in there the policies that are going to be difficult in the next few years and always be able to say, look, I got a 190 majority for that proposal. I've got the right to do it. And I think what was in her mind very much was the experience of the budget, where Philip Hammond did deviate from the 2015 manifesto, tried to raise national insurance contributions for the self-employed. She had to row back. And I think probably people around her just thought, look, put all the unpopular stuff in there, get the green light, the mandate, you're going to beat Corbyn anyway, and then you can govern freely for 5 years.
And hubris, as it turns out. And I think what we've seen with the polling at the moment, and we'll talk about the polling shortly, but the Tories still have an astonishingly big lead amongst pensioners, which explains why they're still in the lead, because they have this huge poll. Labour has a huge poll lead amongst younger voters. But on that key question, who would be best for pensioners? Labour now have a massive lead. Now, that is worrying for the Conservatives, because at the moment, yes, older Britons are still saying, well, even though I'm not happy with them over their policies on pensioners, they're making their electoral decision based on other issues, leadership and so on. But that will possibly start to chip away at the entire basis of the Conservative lead in this country. Not just in the short term, in the long term, because every election since 2005, the Conservatives have gained ground amongst pensioners. Now they've made what could be, you know, something which people remember, not just on the dementia tax, the triple lock and means testing winter payments. But could this be the beginning of a turnaround? I mean, this could be hubris on my part if in 2 weeks' time Labour face an absolute battering at the polls. But it is an interesting potential generational turning point.
I agree. And what's where it's particularly focused is on this point about the dementia tax. And one thing that we all said was that she was really on the rack over the dementia tax. She did that Andrew Neil interview. There was the U-turn that she wouldn't admit was a U-turn. And then the Manchester bombing happened. And we said, well, that's, you know, putting on a political hat for a second, that had helped her just politically, because it had meant that that bit of the campaign was frozen. There was a downside to that, which was, and I've been asking people on the doorstep, did the U-turn cut through? Do people actually realise that the dementia tax isn't going to happen, but in their terms, because they've put in this cap? They didn't have any days to sort of amplify the message to pensioners, to pick up your point, that don't worry, we're not going to do that. So I wonder if there was 4 days of we're going to tax you if you've got dementia, and then suddenly the U-turn got completely obscured by those tragic events in Manchester.
I mean, that's the worst of both worlds in a sense, because you've got a dementia tax, which people thought was cruel and arbitrary and unnecessary in the way it was presented. But then you get the obvious amplification of her looking pretty incompetent.
That
cut through. But because she hasn't set a cap, you know, she said there would be a cap, but it wasn't set at anything. So a Labour can say on the doorstep, your house could be at risk.
That's right.
And that still cuts through in almost as bad a way, but you've got the added incompetence thrown in as well, and the indecision.
Well, you can follow everything on that story and all the twists and turns in this campaign on theguardian.com.
Now, before we get onto the Labour campaign, a question here from Jeff, who responded to our call-out. Thank you, Jeff. And he asked this: given that the opinion polls have been proven so wrong countless times before, why are they given so much credence? Johnny, kick off.
Well, why they're given so much credence is, what else can you go on? I mean, you can go on, and we all do as reporters and sort of analysts of this, the word we're getting from the doorstep, either because we've gone out ourselves as reporters or we're hearing it from candidates and other people involved. So you go on that. But whenever you want to quantify it, because you don't want to say, well, I was out in Darlington and this is what they're saying, but because Darlington could have its own dynamic, you know. To quantify and spread it across the country, you do turn to polls. So that's why we give them some credence. We definitely are giving them much less. You'll notice a lot, The Guardian makes a policy of never leading on opinion polls, and the BBC does the same. So there's less. But you can't, you know, you've got nothing else, you know, quantifiable to go on. The other thing that people do with them, though, is to look at the trend. In other words, not the big numbers, but if they're just generally closing or generally widening. And that has seemed unmistakable, that there has been this narrowing in the Conservative lead. But why we should still trust them, if I had to make a case for should we, you know, still go for them, what I would say is that despite the battering they got in terms of reputation over Brexit, actually, and, you know, I remember it because I was worried about it, Brexit was ahead in those polls, right close to the edge. And even in America, where everyone sort of goes, ha-ha, no one saw Trump coming, actually the popular vote came out more or less as the polls had predicted it, in which Hillary was 2 points or
so
ahead.
State-by-state polling, that was the problem.
State-by-state polling was the problem, and actually in a lot of the states which really turned, there hadn't been much polling because people thought they were in the bag. So I'm not as down on polls as others. That said, British polls do tend to be a bit ropey.
Well, Brexit was a fade of narrative, wasn't it? It was a punditry which felt it was nigh impossible for there to be a vote against the status quo on the EU. We saw that reflected in bets. There was an overwhelming certainty it was going to be Remain. But the polling was there for those who wanted to see it. And that was, I did a video for The Guardian a week before Brexit saying that I thought Brexit was going to happen. One of the main reasons I said that was because of what the opinion polls told me. In Britain, the two big polling disasters are 1992 and 2015. And they overstated what Labour ended up getting, which is why people are often a bit nervy when they say they see the polling going in Labour's favour. Now, in theory, what the pollsters have tried to do is try to correct their methodology since 2015 to avoid giving that inflated polling for Labour. When I speak to pollsters, one of the things they say they do is, because last time round they thought they overrepresented people you could call political enthusiasts. Those are people who are kind of a bit obsessive, a bit sad, like me and you, Johnny. Now,
they could include a large slice of our listening audience
right now.
So tread carefully.
Hello.
Speak kindly of these people.
Hello, fellow losers. Now, they tend to have a bias towards Labour, but the problem the pollsters now have, they say, is that those who aren't political enthusiasts, they often are quite erratic with their political decisions and shift according to what they last saw on TV and radio. In terms of Labour's big shift, because bear in mind, the Tories haven't really gone down in this election campaign. What's happened is Labour is cannibalising the other parties, like the hapless Liberal Democrats under the hapless Tim Farron. But also, it's non-voters and younger voters who are partly increasing Labour's position. Some would worry then, looking at that, bit, if you're like me, a bit nervy, you'd go, well, are they going to come out and vote? That is now Labour's big challenge. Can you mobilise those younger voters and non-voters? Those at the beginning, when Corbyn originally stood, said that would have to be part of their strategy to mobilise those non-voters. So that is their big task. Can Labour pull it off? You know, personally, I hope they throw everything out of that partisan hat on. Now, with all of that said, caveats and all the rest, the polls in the last week have been showing a closer race than at any point in the past 12 months. Now, if you look at that polling, Labour is now doing significantly better than they did in 2015. The caveat being, of course, the Tories are also doing a lot better than they did in 2015. Now, Labour at the moment are defying all expectations and predictions. And I should say, in terms of eating a bit of humble pie, we don't know what the result will be, of course. But even though I myself, you know, backed Jeremy Corbyn and, you know, I ended up in the slightly unhappy position to be called someone who helped destroy the Labour Party and a right-wing sellout, so it was a slightly disorientating position to be in. But my fear was that Labour could be heading for a rout, not because of its visions or policies, but they have they've run a campaign, a remarkable campaign in lots of ways, which has been very clear on vision and policies. The leaking of that manifesto helps them because it meant there was far more coverage and discussion and debate over those policies. They are popular policies. They do cut through. The polling bears that out. So you've got that on the one side. They're running a grassroots insurgent campaign, mass mobilisation of people across the country. And obviously you have the Tory implosion on the other side. So what do you think? Do you also feel you want to,
No, I'm having a little sliver.
You're having a sliver?
I am, and I will eat a much larger slice if what you and I and others have not predicted were to happen, and Jeremy Corbyn were to be standing there on the steps of Downing Street on June the 9th, I will have a full major helping, which perhaps we'll make a little online podcast video of me gorging myself on humble pie. So, but the sliver I have already now is that Corbyn's been a pretty good candidate, and it was clear to somebody like me that he was a very good campaigner in terms of party campaigns through those two leadership campaigns, 2015, 2016. You could see he was happy being a campaigner. He enjoyed it. And just as you can see that somebody like him, I thought, was uncomfortable in his own skin at, say, Prime Minister's questions, I think he's very comfortable in his own skin out there campaigning. He's been a good candidate and an energetic one. And for example, just to pick one small example, his interview with Jeremy Vine on, mass audience Radio 2, was excellent. He was, you know, warm. He was affable. He didn't answer every question, but he's a politician. That's fine. He was good on it. So he's been a better campaigner than somebody like me thought. I don't think that's the whole story. I do think also that the manifesto does have a lot of very popular policies. If they were neck and neck now, the two parties, the very popularity of those policies could now be coming to hurt them, because now there would be a different level of scrutiny, which would start saying, you're promising absolutely everything. How are you going to pay for it? And I know we've had those sort of Diane Abbott exchanges about literal numbers, but I mean, in a bigger picture way, are you just showering everyone with largesse? Is this really credible and serious? If you're 5, 6, 7, 10 points behind, you don't get that kind of scrutiny. Instead, he's had a lot of scrutiny about his past, IRA stuff. I'm not sure for generationally, for younger people, that matters. So overall, he's having a pretty good campaign. And what brilliant timing, he's having a good campaign while, as we said, the Tories are having an absolute living nightmare.
And I think, I mean, Matt Zarkuzin, who's Jeremy Corbyn's former press officer, his view in terms of what's happened is this, that in an election campaign, broadcasting impartiality rules kick in. And for the first time, arguably, the main opposition party has a kind of unfiltered opportunity to present its policies and its vision. We know, and I'm not using this as the crutch that some on the left do, but we know the press is overwhelmingly hostile to the Labour Party, and particularly hostile to the left of the Labour Party, which is now obviously the ruling faction of that party. But in terms of broadcasting now, you have this they have this huge platform which on a daily basis they can present their policies and their ideas in a way that can cut through. And the image that's been presented of Jeremy Corbyn, because he had a very bad first impression, people saw the first week and various mishaps happened because they didn't expect to win. But they're now having, I think, an opportunity to challenge that first impression, which cut through. And perhaps the early election actually has ended up helping Labour, in the sense that if this had gone on for another couple of years, people's view of Jeremy Corbyn could have hardened quite a lot more. But perhaps it was a lot softer, that first impression, because he's only been around for a year and a half as leader of the opposition.
Yeah.
So perhaps actually, because he's not been around that much, his second first impression, if you like, given, you know, the press are very hostile, but people can see him for the first time, unfiltered, perhaps people can see the real Jeremy Corbyn, and perhaps they don't quite dislike him as much as they thought they did.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the sort of judgment that you can make properly once we have the result.
Yeah,
I
mean, of course. And the caveat is Labour still are on course, if the polling is right, to be defeated.
To be defeated. But the scale of the defeat will be relevant, and whether or not Labour itself, because that's going to be a big story afterwards, what conclusion do they draw from it, if that is the result? Do they think, well, we came damn close, or do they think, wow, that is an absolute drubbing? And that depends entirely on the scale, etc. So, but at the moment, it's giving me a little bit of a sort of deja vu of 1987, where Neil Kinnock had, by common consensus, a very good campaign. Still lost by 100 seats, though.
Yeah.
They chipped away at what had been a 144-seat majority. So he could claim, look, I've won seats. But he personally and individually had a good campaign, good enough for it to allow him to carry on as leader. And I have thought that this has felt to me like a good campaign for the individual leader. He's been much more sort of coherent and effective than sceptics, including me, thought he would be. But in the context of overall lagging behind, and probably, if all the polls and everything are right, a losing campaign.
And just quickly on that, I mean, the issue is the UKIP collapse. And, you know, that's why the Tories have inflated their lead. You've got this reunification of the right, if you like. They've become the Brexit party, the Conservatives, and that's why they're on 44.
But we shouldn't just think, by the way, that was an absolute law of nature and inevitable. A lot of working class voters could have said, well, Brexit's done now, I can go back home
to
Labour.
But that's the point I'm making, actually.
So it wasn't certain they would go to the Tories.
Well, actually, that's partly why Labour are doing better, is the point I was going to make. I was in Norwich, actually, on Saturday and met UKIP people who voted UKIP last time, who are voting for the Labour Party this time. And some of the polling suggests perhaps about 30% of ex-UKIP voters are going to the Labour Party. So the vast majority are going to the Conservatives, but some of those are ex-Labour voters, 2005 perhaps, and they're returning to the fold. Will it be enough? Well, Labour, you know, still have all the odds stacked against them, but they've defied a lot of predictions. And for that, again, a lot of people may end up eating humble pie, but it could still be not the result people like me want. So there's a big caveat.
We're joined now in the pod by Matthias Kolb, who is a political reporter for Süddeutsche Zeitung, which, of course, Guardian podcast listeners will all know and read daily, I'm sure. But it's a big and important German newspaper. And Matthias, I'm very aware that this is like the height of kind of egotism and narcissism, which is to say, we've just been talking about us. Now we want you to talk about us. We're interested in what you
think really about Britain and this election.
Now, in terms of the pretext of this general election, Theresa May argued that she needed a bigger majority because that would strengthen her hand in negotiations with other European governments, including, of course, your own. How do you think people in Germany feel about that? Does anyone in Germany care how many extra seats she gets? And will that change the negotiating position of Britain?
I think people expect the Tories to win and probably Theresa May to make some gains. I think the hope or the expectation is more that Theresa May has a mandate to be a little bit more flexible in her negotiation position. I think Chancellor Merkel made it very clear in her own speeches, both before the Bundestag and on other occasions, that she thinks that May's position and strategy is, I think, quote unquote, totally unrealistic. Pretty obvious. I think she's very much in line with Juncker and all these people just by saying you cannot just do all the cherry picking. I mean, like, if you want to end the free movement of people, just like, you will have to pay a price for that. You cannot take all the benefits and all the advantages of being a European Union member and kind of like, yeah, walk away from the things that are more about solidarities. I think that's kind of like the hope. Okay, hopefully she will win. And then she can kind of like keep her own, the people in her own party, like a little bit more calm and then be more flexible.
So just quickly on that, I think that's such a critical point, because I think the way it's presented in this in this country is that by the Conservatives and the press that support them is this gives her room to be tougher, to be stronger, to be more hardline. But actually the expectation you have is, well, won't have a tiny majority. She won't have all these back benches.
She'll have more room for manoeuvre.
Exactly, keeping a hostage. So she'll actually be able to weaken in terms of
softer Brexit.
Brexit.
I think that's the hope. I think the EU27 is pretty united in that. And I think Merkel is very strong on that. I think also Martin Schulz, like the leader of the Social Democratic Party, who's trying to kick her out of the chancellorship. Social Democrats also think similarly, that just like the EU27 has to stick together. Of course, there is the will and I think the aim to find a deal that's good for both sides. But it cannot be about cherry picking. I think there's more the sense of, we have to stick together as a EU27. We don't want to send a signal that just like some other country might say, okay, worked well for Britain, now we might leave the European Union as well. I think it's more about showing the people, the public, that we are willing to keep on going with the European Union. We want to stay united. And if someone wants to leave, okay, that's okay. But we're not going to be super generous about that.
It is fascinating what the point Owen was making, which is, I'm just trying to work out who's the delusional party here, whether it's us in Britain. I mean, you know, us not meaning Owen and me, but meaning the British political classes, and particularly the government and its supporters, or the Germans, because the idea that there does seem to have been this kind of fantasy from the day after, from June 24th, 2016, after the referendum, that somehow they don't really mean it, that this is going to be unraveled. And there was a view that actually one of the reasons for calling this election was to send a message to the Europeans that, look, we mean it. Don't start hoping and having any fantasies that actually, you know, it's going to get overruled in Parliament or thrown out. She means business and she really does mean a hard Brexit. And I'm just wondering if the view you've just outlined is in some ways a bit of a kind of wishful thinking.
Probably. I mean, I think, of course, I think it depends who you talk to. Of course, there's a strong interest from the business side. I mean, there are lots of German companies that are invested here in Great Britain. So I think, of course, they will argue and kind of like make their pitch by saying just, okay, like we have to work that out. We cannot just like let it collapse on March 29 and 2019 and then nobody knows what is going to happen. So, of course, Merkel and all the other leaders in the EU27 have to kind of like find that compromise between, yeah, like business interest and taking a principal stance. But I think when you look at also like at opinion polls, I think it's in the 70, 75, 80% range of Germans saying what's most important in the negotiations about Brexit are the long-term interests of the EU27 countries. Kind of like we have a sympathy for the United Kingdom.
Because the pro-Brexit people here say, Germany, in the end, they want to sell their BMWs to people in, you know, Birmingham and Leeds, and therefore they'll accept anything. And what you're saying, I have to say, it buttresses my own view, which is actually for Germans in particular, the survival of the EU really, really matters.
Well, you know, I met some EU diplomats before the referendum, and the point they made to me, it wasn't vengeance that would drive the negotiating position of the other EU states, but it was survival partly. But one of the issues was that European voters already felt that Britain has special treatment, and that this kind of resentment, if you like, would have a huge impact on what the governments of those different countries did. Is that true? Do you think there is a sense of resentment that exists towards Britain? Is it likely to get greater? And what impact do you think it will have on whatever deal is negotiated, if any deal is negotiated?
Yeah. I mean, I think Germans who follow politics in general are aware that you kind of like had the special deal and Maggie Thatcher negotiated that quite some time ago. And I think, of course, we all learned, in especially in Germany, that just like our take on European Union and feeling European is very, very different from how the perception is here across the channel. So I think, and it's a little bit like generational as well. I think people like of my age, like the generation of Erasmus, I think just like we are still shocked to a certain extent, just because it feels so unbelievable that European Union could break up in a way and that anyone could just like, I don't know, challenge that or tear it apart. And I think we have a strong sympathy towards all the young Brits and Scots and young Welsh, just by saying just like you are just like cheated and betrayed by older people who just like take away all the opportunities. I think that's a very generational thing.
Matthias Kolb, thank you very much for coming in here. Of course, Owen and I are going to appear on the Süddeutsche Zeitung daily election podcast in speaking in fluent German to talk about your campaign in just a matter of months. So we look forward to that. But
that was
terrific. What a tour de force. Thank you.
Great stuff.
All right, we're almost out of time, but make sure you're subscribed to Election Daily. Follow us on Twitter. I'm at Friedland and Owen is at OwenJones84.
But before we go, quick bit of cheeky recommended reading. We'll link to all those pieces on the podcast page. Johnny, what's caught your eye today?
Well, Matt Singh is the election analyst for the FT, and he has wrestled with the question you and I were talking about before, which is about the polling and what's the variation. Okay, nerd warning coming up, which is the nerd klaxon sounds. His key point is that the variation depends on whether or not you believe people when they tell you about their own likelihood to vote. So when you take voters at face value and you accept when they tell you they're likely to vote, then you get a much smaller Tory lead because younger people and previous non-voters tell the pollsters, yep, I'm going to vote. The other polling companies that say, not listening to what you say about yourself, I'm looking at past behaviour and analyse it based on the past, look at non-voters and young voters and are very sceptical and say, I know you're telling me you're going to vote, but I don't believe you. And therefore, I'm going to count lower for Labour. And therefore, you get these bigger leads. So who is right? Once again, it's one of the things we won't know till June the 9th. But the polling analyst Matt Singh in the FT unpacks this very well today.
And the piece, which I think is quite interesting, is Jeremy Gilbert, who's a very interesting writer. He's written an opinion piece for The Guardian, Can Labour Win Back Its Heartlands Not By Turning Blue? It's basically a polemic against so-called Blue Labour. Blue Labour is a wing of Labour associated with people like Maurice Glassman, who believe basically in social conservatism of a certain kind, flag, family, religion, faith, and perhaps a more economically social democratic programme than New Labour offered. But it meant kind of often challenging things like, well, multiculturalism, immigration, not being quite so hot on things perhaps like LGBT rights. But this is a polemic against that. I mean, it looks at how New Labour did combine economic liberalism but at the same time embraced, LGBT rights, feminism of a certain brand and so on. But he says that, this isn't the way Blue Labour of reconstituting that coalition, which is, of course, not what Jeremy Corbyn's leadership have done. They've combined, LGBT rights, feminism with economic interventionism. I always thought it was a very patronising view of the working class, I have to say. It's this idea of a white working class when working class communities are the most diverse. Polling on LGBT rights suggests that working class people are often more accepting than middle class people. Personally, I'm not sure I'd walk around Surrey holding hands with my partner, but probably in many inner city areas I'd be far more comfortable. So I think it's a very interesting piece because that has been an ongoing debate in Labour within the last few years.
So that's your reading for today. In terms of viewing, I'm sure you're going to be joining the rest of the nerd community, as I like to think of us, in watching Jeremy Paxman's interviews with the party leaders, Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn, later on today. We'll be back perhaps to talk about that and everything else in the campaign tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.